Hi, and welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. You've been working tirelessly to raise awareness of the role of nutrition in health, both physical health and mental health, Dr. Jaffe. I was hoping we could begin by you telling me where that inspiration has come from for this. Was there one moment that made you realise that nutrition was such a big missing piece of the puzzle, or was it the culmination of lots of little experiences that led you to that conclusion?
I think lots of little experiences, probably the latter. And I think for me, it came from personal interest, and it happened for me when I was 19, and it was just before I started medical school, so about 10 years ago now, and I hadn't got in first time round, so I took a year out to retry again, etc. And in that time and space away from like being within an institution, whether it was school or university, I really had time to kind of think about what I'm interested in prior to starting medical school. And that's when I started joining organizations, listening to podcasts, reading books that were all focused around a proactive approach to healthcare rather than a reactive approach, and how the role of preventative medicine can be absolutely paramount to reducing the high rise of lifestyle-related chronic disease. So nutrition was a central piece of that puzzle and became a huge passion of mine because I'm a foodie. I love food as an exploration of culture, as a language to learn about someone else, as a way to celebrate, as a way to grieve. I think for me, food is all encompassing, and I'd always loved food. But then when I realized the impact it has on health, and the fact that I was then, when I did get into medical school on that year out, I was then going on to train as a doctor, I realized, wow, I want to be a doctor who talks about the absolute power of food as medicine, as Hippocrates stated all those years ago, and really unpick what we can do to put health in the public, in patients' hands, so that they can make changes to themselves and only really, you know, this is very blue sky thinking, only have to see healthcare professionals when they're at a crisis point or when they need support, but they have this information to be able to take charge themselves. So it was a huge central piece of my puzzle and my passion. And then I started medical school and realized, oh gosh, I'm totally naive. We're not actually going to learn anything about nutrition and lifestyle. We're going to mainly look at the biomedical approach of what health is. And that's when I realized, oh gosh, need to shake up the system and stand on the shoulders of giants that came before me who had been talking about this for years, about having a more proactive approach to health care that involves food and nutrition. And that's when NutriTank, my non-for-profit, which educates healthcare professionals and healthcare students around the role of nutrition and lifestyle to prevent, manage, and sometimes even reverse chronic disease, that's when that all started.
I want to get to that in a second, but firstly, paint us a picture of what it was like when you came to that realization as part of your training that nutrition was such a small part of it. Because my experience of speaking to a lot of doctors and other medical professionals is we're just not trained in this, even though nutrition obviously has a huge role in the cause and the prevention of many chronic diseases. It seems as though it's just completely missing from any kind of educational process. Talk us through what it's actually like, you know, in the classroom, on the ground.
Exactly. So I went to Bristol Medical School, and each medical school is set up entirely differently. How it was for me is we had the first couple years of learning about the fundamental sciences that are the fundamental sciences that underpin medicine, so physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, pharmacology, etc. And then we were seeing patients quite early on, which is not always the case with other medical schools. But when we were in these lectures, we were learning about the physiology, the anatomy, and the biochemistry of the digestive system. But absolutely, really nothing was touched upon about the role of prevention, the role of nutrition as an intervention for chronic conditions. It was more just, like I said, teaching you the anatomy of the mouth to the mouth to anus digestive tract, and the biochemistry that, to be perfectly honest with you, is a quite dull the Krebs cycle, as you'll find many medics say, and not particularly useful unless you're a highly, highly specialist to be able to help your patients there and then around nutrition. So the nutrition that we were being taught was not practical and not really translational to being able to help someone who's got a diagnosis of prediabetes, who's got poor mental health but isn't yet in a mental health crisis, to actually make changes for themselves. And it was very kind of confronting and also really confusing, because when my co-founder of NutriTank and I, who was a medical student with me at Bristol, when we looked at the NICE guidelines, which is the National Institute of Care and Excellence, it's the healthcare guidelines that in this country all healthcare professionals abide by for every condition. And obviously, that's incredibly important to be able to have that standardized approach of what is evidence-based. And when you look at the first line intervention for nearly every chronic condition, from polycystic ovarian syndrome, diabetes, to hypertension, high blood pressure, the first line intervention is offer patients diet and lifestyle advice. So lip service is being paid. There is some sort of acknowledgement that one must do that as a healthcare professional, but you get no teaching on how to do that. So what ends up happening, if you take an example into GP land, where a lot of these conversations, you know, are mainly taking place, or you'd want them to take place, is a GP, it's never their fault, it's the system of education's fault, is only able to really sometimes say, unless they're obviously trained in these things, eat less and move more, or you should have a healthy lifestyle, but they're not able to elaborate because we're not taught that.
So what are some of the big challenges then? Because you can understand and sympathize with a GP who maybe has got a waiting room full of clients. They've got six minutes with somebody who's got high blood pressure. It's easier to prescribe the medication than to talk to them about reducing salt or getting more exercise. What is that the main challenge you feel that we're facing, or are there any others you can illuminate us about?
This is a really great question, and it came up very early on by all our seniors and all the kind of senior leaders who are in charge of being able to execute these changes. And so what are the greatest barriers towards doctors on the front line giving diet and lifestyle advice? We actually did a paper on this, and it was published in 2019, or it could have been a little bit before that, but it was called Time for Nutrition Education. It was published in the BMJ with Elaine McEninch, a brilliant dietitian, as the lead author, and my NutriTank co-founder and I as co-authors amongst our other collaborators. And now this was a huge landmark research paper. We surveyed hundreds of junior doctors and medical students across the country to ask them what their main barriers were to being able to give this advice and to learn about this advice. And the number one barrier that was identified and got the highest votes was due to a lack of confidence, right? Rather than due to a lack of time. And that was this huge paradigm shift where we realized, well, how do you become more confident? You become more confident through really rigorous training and greater knowledge. And everything was kind of, it came down to this moment where a lot of our skeptics had said curriculum crowding, GPs don't have enough time in a 10-minute consultation, all of these kind of barriers around time. But actually the main thing that people on the front line, people in this position cited as the barrier, was due to a lack of confidence that they weren't bringing it to the forefront of their consultation, no matter what the time barriers were. And I think that comes down to the fact that when you are, I'm not a GP, I'm a trainee psychiatrist, but I have huge respect for my GP colleagues who have a very short period of time with their patients. And what kind of I hear from conversations with them is that when you're really busy, you go into your default mode network of automatic, autopilot. I've got this knowledge. I've seen loads of patterns within my patients. So I'm going to go for what I know, low hanging fruit, to suggest things. A lot of the time that can culminate to a prescription because, like you say, it's easy and practical. We have the most teaching around pharmacology. But actually, if through NutriTank's ethos, you train medical students and then all the way through to postgraduate healthcare professionals, if you train them around nutrition and lifestyle medicine interventions, they then get that programmed into their automatic toolbox as a busy, time-pressured clinician on the front line to be able to quickly say to a patient, have you considered making changes to your diet and lifestyle, plant the seed, not expecting any miracle work in a 10-minute consultation, but be able to know exactly where to signpost that patient for more information. And should they wish to book in for a further appointment to discuss these changes, then, or go see a dietitian or registered nutritionist, then they can do that. But if the GPs or the healthcare professionals aren't primed to even think, oh, what's my toolbox for helping a patient? Medication, social prescription, nutrition, lifestyle, sometimes surgery if needed. If you're not primed to even think about that tool, you're not going to mention it. And it's going to be a lack of confidence rather than a lack of time.
It's another big potential issue in your experience, one that's maybe not talked about as much, one that the patient wants medication. They may not want the nutrition advice, because if you're in a scenario where you can be given a pill that's going to solve most of your problems, or you can undertake 6 months of exercise that you don't think you enjoy, and nutrition you're going to find very, very difficult, again, most people are probably going to take the pill, right? How big an issue is this?
I think that is an amazing question, Joe, and something we really need to discuss, because like you say, it's a shared partnership between doctor and patient, or healthcare professional like dietitians and patients. And you need to understand, where are they coming from? What do they want? In GP land, you say ICE. So ideas, concerns and expectations of that patient. And you're taught that a medical school is a way to address things. And that is so important, because we need to know, where's the patient coming from and what do they want? What are their cultural norms? What's their budget, etc. And this comes down to a much wider issue of, what are the social determinants of health, and why aren't we discussing them more frequently as the barriers for patients who are living in food deserts to be able to make these changes? So that's a huge part of NutriTank's work as well. We're not expecting everyone is actually able to access good nutrition and lifestyle. And that's why you have an issue with the government, of course, but also why we can really just be grateful for some of the brilliant work going on in the third sector and charity space, like the Alexandra Rose charity that actually gets fruits and vegetables prescribed to patients. It's very sad we've got to a situation where fruits and vegetables, a natural part of life of our ancestors, etc., are being medicalized. And likewise with social prescription, it's a sad case that we are in a loneliness epidemic in our modern society, so we've had to call something social prescription to reduce loneliness, isolation in our communities. But that's where we're at, and that's what we need to work with. And so your question about, well, what if the patient wants a quick fix? What if they want a pill for every ill, because they are also functioning in this biomedical paradigm that we've been in for so long? Well, then it's a question of actually allowing the patient to make an informed decision. And you can only do that if you yourself have the education and knowledge as the healthcare professional. So what I would suggest is that if you imagine a doctor-patient consultation and a patient comes in with high blood pressure, but it's not at crisis point of, oh my goodness, you know, because we obviously have a grading system of hypertension, stage one, stage two, stage three. If it's not at crisis point, I would say you could have that kind of pre-contemplative motivational interviewing conversation where you can plant the seed to the patient and say, have you considered changing your diet and lifestyle? What's your family set up? Do you have anyone at home that you could do this with and create a whole kind of household change? Something like that, or a partner you could be out accountable with, or a work buddy that, you know, you could go on walks with rather than driving to work. Who knows what the change is practically. But I think if you don't ask the question and then actually put out to them what their options are, and then allow them to make the informed decision, and you just give them prescription, you've made the decision for them. You've not offered them an option. So choice is paramount. Of course, some people are going to want a pill for every ill, and there is no judgment towards that. But what I would strongly kind of suggest is that if you can actually say to the patient that there are side effects that come with medication, and you have to think about polypharmacy, so patients on multiple medications and how they all interact with one another, because that can reduce quality of life, because with multiple side effects from multiple medications. And you also have to think about, what's their access like? So I think it's absolutely crucial, the question you've asked, and it is a problem, but it's about laying out all the options on a menu for the patient and allowing them to make an informed decision with all the right information holistically.
Let's pretend you wake up tomorrow and you're charged with completely overhauling the nutritional education information around medicine for junior doctors. What are the big rocks that you put into place to make sure that all junior doctors are taught? And then following on from that, realistically, what can NutriTank do? What are your kind of your primary aims in terms of making those, you know, disrupting the system, as you say, and making those changes?
I'd tackle that from two perspectives. Well, actually three perspectives. I'm going to say the healthcare professional as an educator, the healthcare professional as a consumer and as a patient for their own health and well-being, and then the patient and public population. So what would I do for the system? So taking it from the top, our primary aim of NutriTank was to and is to educate healthcare professionals and students about nutrition and lifestyle interventions to be able to act as another tool in their toolbox when managing and trying to prevent and sometimes even reverse chronic disease. So I'd want that to be completely a wide swept approach in undergraduate training, and it be closely compulsory for medical students to be assessed in nutrition and lifestyle consultations, because we do a lot of role plays throughout medical school with patient actors. And for instance, it's like, you have a smoking cessation scenario, you have a break bad news scenario, for instance, if you have to tell a patient they've got cancer, and you need to make sure that in every medical school training program, that medical students are trained in motivational interviewing, health coaching, and the ability to be able to really meet the patient where they're at with what their cultural is, their cultural background is. So not just recommending the Mediterranean diet to everyone who it might not make sense for if that's not what they tend to eat from their cultural national background. And so really getting that skills set within the training program. And we know that assessment drives learning. It will not be computed into the busy medical student's brain if it's not assessed. So making sure that it's completely compulsory and assessed to be taught around nutrition and lifestyle. So that would be the undergraduate side. Postgraduate, I would love to see that every Royal College, so from Royal College of Pediatrics, Royal College of Psychiatry, GP, you name it, surgery, have an agenda around nutrition and lifestyle postgraduate training. And again, are having these consultation skills workshops and are also talking about making every contact count, which was an NHS campaign whereby any healthcare professional has an opportunity to plant that seed for change in a patient's mind. So being able to actually train the workforce to be able to have these conversations where appropriate, whether that's in A&E, in a community clinic, in a prehabilitation post with an anaesthetist doing it before a patient is going into surgery, which is all about making someone as fit as possible physically before they go onto the knife, which carries complications. So if we can have these touch points in the whole of the healthcare system where healthcare professionals are trained to actually talk to patients about diet and lifestyle and get them into the practice of self-management at home, whether that's having a home blood pressure machine, etc., I think that would be absolutely paramount. And then the other piece, which I mentioned, is about the well-being and health of healthcare professionals themselves. So NutriTank are working on a national hospital food research project, which looks at the occupational food environment as harmful to the healthcare professional on shift work. Because if we can't provide nutritious food out of hours to our healthcare staff who are on nights, on weekends, out of hours, and can only give them ultra processed food filled vending machines, then how do we expect us to be role models to patients? It just doesn't make sense. So I think we really need to look at hospitals and the food environment from an occupational sense, but for the workforce, but also from the perspective of relatives and patients themselves. Because a story really quickly, when I was working on a stroke ward as a junior doctor, we were a center where we were doing amazing clot busting treatment called thrombolysis for people who had ischemic strokes. Now this is A, very expensive, and it's B, completely life-changing, because obviously you can get there early and bust the clot. But it's a case of, well, we've made the modern medicine intervention, but what about a sustainable lifestyle going forward to prevent this from happening again? And what I would see, and no judgment or fault of the families and relatives, but after their relative had this life-changing clot-busting treatment, they would come in and shower their relatives with gifts in the form of ultra-processed foods that I would see on the patient's bedside table that you know, is completely counterproductive and counterintuitive to the healing process of this person, especially because lifestyle is a huge factor that obviously genetics do and all of that would have been a huge factor for them to get to this point. So I think it's about creating a food environment for the staff and the patients and the relatives that is actually healthful rather than harmful. And I think that kind of all encompasses your question.
There's clearly a lot to do. Before we get to some of those solutions and how likely they are, why do you think we've got the system we have in terms of the lack of education for medical professionals around nutrition and lifestyle? It's easy for me to sit here and be cynical and say the influence of big pharma, the drug lobbies. Obviously, there's always the incentive for people to prescribe medicines rather than taking a more long-term holistic view. But I want to believe there's another reason. There's maybe an easily fixable reason for why there is such a lack of attention around such fundamentally important aspects of health and well-being.
Absolutely. I think it's hugely multifaceted and it intersects with almost every aspect of society, of politics, of socioeconomics, like we discussed earlier, the social determinants of health, and also education. So I think where I believe things are kind of taken a turn is the NHS was set up in 1948 for the purpose of acute care because that was what they were dealing with in society. And so it was an amazing free service that was hugely, hugely appreciated and well functioning to be able to deal with acute problems. Now, as you go further and further into modern living and the rise of technology, food industry innovations, etc., how we preserve foods, how we create foods, and if we carry on going into the 21st century, we know that our food environment has taken a turn for the worse. We know that convenience food has completely overridden whole foods, whole food cooking from scratch. We know that we have a rise of food technology back in the 20th century. Deliveroo, Uber Eats, Just Eat, whatever, all these things, they didn't exist. And so we have got so many factors at play as to how our food environment and how behaviours have changed. We've got modern transport that allows us to not walk as much in our city. We've got a lot of ease that essentially stops us from walking elevators and lifts instead of taking the stairs, etc., etc. And we've also had a loss of community. And I think what is so wonderful about the social prescription movement is that this is now an antidote to this loss of community. And so neighbours scratch cooking and bringing each other foods and, a whole community cooking together, etc. We've lost that. And I think it really is kind of we've become siloed off into our own homes, into our own communities, when it comes to the food scene, and we rely on convenience. And then when you take it into the healthcare world, we are completely overstretched and under-resourced with the healthcare system because it's now become a system for chronic disease, because we've gone from that acute care to loads of really complex problems within our population, because people are living for longer and people aren't necessarily living better, but they're living longer and they're living with polypharmacy, with multiple medications for multiple comorbidities, with a pill for every ill and side effects and all of that. And so we are under-resourced. There's a lack of time for patients to actually get advice from healthcare professionals. There's waiting lists through the roof. And we're just in a bit of a hot mess, to be honest with you. And then my worry is patients go to social media and then consume health information that isn't evidence-informed, evidence-based from influencers and people. And then we've opened up a whole other Pandora's box. So how have we got here? We've got here because there's not enough funding for our healthcare system in general for the public to access it. Food is expensive. There's a cost of living crisis. And people also crave convenience and people have lost the joy of cooking and food. It's not being taught enough in the educational system with food tech as it used to be. So I feel like I could write a dissertation on this. There are so many factors as to why we've got here, and also this mindset of biomedical model, reactive approach, rather than let's put out the fire from the beginning and go to the root cause of, you know, how we can change the entire system through lifestyle and nutrition and social interventions.
At the risk of sounding incredibly naive, why have we not seen change? Because the potential cost saving of not only countless thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives, improving the quality of life, but saving billions off the NHS budget by changing the approach and prioritizing some of the things you've mentioned. Am I incredibly naive, or is it a case of during the 2008 crash, big banks were too big to fail? Is the NHS too big to change?
That is, wow, that's a brilliant question. Is the NHS too big to change? I believe that it's become very disjointed, and actually it's very hard to have centralized change. So you do kind of have to do things by regions, by trusts. Every trust is like its own little business. Every medical school is autonomous. Every medical school has its own curriculum with its own specialty faculty. So it's actually very hard to create a standardized holistic change. I do think it has to kind of be done in a kind of pilot model approach, where you do it at one NHS site or in one primary care network or one medical school, prove that it works, and then try and roll it out that way. Because I actually think it's very hard to just do it from the top and ripple down. But your question of, are you incredibly naive why we haven't actually got to this change with, you know, the rising stats, which are, you know, incredibly, they're incredibly real and they're incredibly burdensome. So just to kind of share a few stats of, you know, what you've alluded to, is we know that the NHS spends £10 billion a year on diabetes, which is around 10% of its budget. And it spends £6.1 billion on obesity, and that was in 2019. So that's a huge wake-up call in my mind. But you're right, why haven't we really seen the change? And I think it's because there are so many different vested interests. There are so many different parties at play, moving parts at play. I truly believe the reactive approach is kind of the low-hanging fruit, because it's such a big problem to solve and you want to help people fast at the same time. So in a way, medication first makes the most sense. But I think the whole system obviously needs to be slightly disrupted. And there's definitely really good intentions there, because like I mentioned, nice first line management for every chronic condition is offer patients diet and lifestyle. But, you know, it's very hard to know. If I believe that maybe there's just not the right team assembled to kind of own this issue and then create a widespread solution. And what we see in the medical school sphere is that people who then on the faculty who then get given the role to implement more nutrition into medical schools, they already have a full-time job. It becomes an add-on. So I think within the workforce, within the NHS, there needs to be more funding to create a dedicated team that solely deals with the issue of diet and lifestyle interventions roll out from an educational perspective to train the workforce. It's very complicated. I can't really answer it in its entirety. Why have we not seen more change? I don't know if there's enough manpower in a way.
Do you feel as though technology or other innovations could potentially help? I mean, in specifically looking at maybe personalized medicine, right? Or people having, complete DNA genetic testing so we can identify risk factors early to get ahead of it. Obviously, that those kind of technologies are beginning to trickle through now. Obviously nowhere near ready for mass rollout across an institution like the NHS. But I guess I'm trying to find little kind of silver, bits of sunlight in the storm clouds in terms of, do you feel optimistic that something like that could maybe be the trickle that leads to a flood of change?
So very great question and very current. And this is where I kind of put my skeptics hat on. And I am a big believer in technology to be able to impact masses. We can't go without technology, because how do you impact masses fast? We know that the media do that very well. If there's a public health message that we all need to see, we will access it best through mass media and social media, because that's what we're consuming. But actual health tech platforms, I am slightly skeptical about making them sound like the sexiest solution and therefore the most effective solution. And in my mind, sexy and trendy doesn't equal effective or necessarily or necessarily right or credible. I think that we are not doing the basics right, and we are not doing the basics from an educational stance, that we need to actually tackle that first. And I truly believe that personalized medicine is the future, but we are not there yet with the right tech to be able to roll that out. The science still needs to come a long way before we can make generalized sweeping public health statements about the gut microbiome. We're still in a situation with the gut microbiome where two healthy individuals will have completely different micro populations. And so how can you actually make any inferences to make huge public health guidelines from a nutrition standpoint when you know that two individuals who are functioning well from a health perspective have different bacterial populations? And all we know is that diversity. The one thing we do know is diversity is absolutely crucial if we're zooming in on the gut microbiome, but we don't know which are the most beneficial strains for health. So my point being here is that there are a lot of things out there that are really sexy, that are incredibly interesting, but are we actually there yet to roll it out as the solution? I don't think so at all. I think we need to work on the basics, educate the healthcare workforce around the basic nutrition lifestyle interventions, and rather than rely on wearable techs and things like that, where again, I don't think from a cost perspective that will actually end up being that feasible for a national rollout. And we need to be able to help create healthier local communities, which is why if it were me and I was in charge, I would put more I think I've frozen, Joe. Can you hear me? I would put, you know, I don't want to put all my eggs in any basket, but if I were to put my eggs in a particular basket right now, it would be social prescription and creating healthier communities where we can actually get people out of the four walls of a clinic or of a hospital into the communities, and, you know, South Asian cooking projects to reduce type 2 diabetes prevalence, cooking and walking groups for socially isolated elderly, whatever it is, that is where I would put my eggs in. Yeah, that was where I'd put my eggs in the basket, rather than saying tech and wearables and personalized medicine seems like the right solution. Let's roll that out. I would actually focus at getting healthy communities scaled up more.
Talk to me about educating the healthcare workforce, because you just touched upon it there. I'm really interested in your, what's your experience of when you're talking to colleagues about the changes you want and the importance of these lifestyle interventions? Specifically, is there a big difference in reaction between speaking to people your age and the older generation who might be a bit more adverse to change? Paint me a picture of what it's like when you're actually having these conversations.
Really important question, because there are generational there's generational variation in standpoints, and but that's not to say that I could make any sort of generalization between millennials are more for this and the old generations aren't, because all my mentors from Bristol Medical School, who I've just been with at this brilliant integrative healthcare conference over the last few days, they've been wanting this change for absolute years, and they've been doing things like social prescription and lifestyle medicine without those labels that we've now assigned to them. They've been doing it intuitively. So is there a kind of difference between healthcare professionals? I would say there often is, and you can kind of say that quite generally sometimes, that different specialties vary on their standpoint. So for instance, GPs seem to be the most primed for this change, because A, they are the holistic frontline healthcare professionals that patients see, versus people sometimes in secondary care, for instance, like surgeons, not all surgeons, there are amazing surgeons out there that are more interventionalists, and that's what they've kind of specialized to do, and to cut people open and, you know, solve the problem from that point of view. I think that isn't an issue at all. For instance, we know how crucial bariatric surgery is, but they are at the end stage of sometimes patients' journeys. So they aren't necessarily as they're not as primed, for instance, as healthcare professionals that are seeing patients maybe earlier on in their health journey, where an early intervention can take place. By the time you've got to surgery, you're more at an end stage of a health condition, for instance. So there is variety in opinion within different specialties, but I also think there is variety in generations. And when we were at Bristol and we pitched this to our faculty, and again, not all the members of our faculty, a lot of our mentors come from Bristol, but some of the senior members of our faculty turned around to Ian and I, my co-founder, when we were like second years trying to pitch this about 10 years ago. They're like, well, I'm a very experienced and kind of esteemed doctor. I've not needed this education. So why do you? Like, I've got my patients better. I've got, you know, I've been working in the NHS for 30 years. Why do we need this? And that was our first real experience of inertia and skepticism and almost like cognitive dissonance as well, where you know that you want to help, but what you're doing doesn't necessarily help, but you can't quite detach from that and see the wood from the trees. And so that was an important experience for us because it showed us what we were up against. And then we obviously had our senior medical mentors that really helped us. And then what our big thing was creating a community of kind of millennial Gen Z medics across the country who wanted this change, not only for themselves, so not only for their patients, but also for themselves. They don't want to be at risk of burnout as much as the more senior generations, and they want to be able to learn how to cope better with nutrition lifestyle interventions for when they're on a night shift, for when they're working back to back, and not kind of have that toxic mindset that a lot of medics have of, I'll sleep when I'm dead and I'll give until I've got nothing left to give. So that's the kind of shift that we've seen in our generation. And it can't make a sweeping generalization statement about the different generations, but there definitely are skeptics who don't think we need it because they've not needed it. But like I've mentioned, they were practicing from a time where the NHS was more geared up for acute healthcare issues, and now we're in a mess of just pure chronic conditions.
Do you feel that your message, you're trying to deliver your message with a tailwind or a headwind? I'm trying to get a sense of whether or not you feel that the momentum is with you, or it's still an incredible resistance that lays ahead.
I completely think the momentum's with us. I'm very, very hopeful. I think when you asked the previous question about why have we not seen mass change yet in the NHS, I think that is definitely a way to feel disillusioned and disappointment and disenchanted, because you're taking it from such a bird's eye view approach. But we are seeing change on the ground. And that's what I'm really passionate about, is this bottom-up approach, is that I can tell you thousands of stories of GP practices, consultant psychiatrists who are practicing with nutrition and lifestyle more holistically and actually de-prescribing psychiatric medications from patients. Not to say that I'm anti-psychiatric medication at all, but it's just the judicious use of psychotropic medications I'm for. And so there are a million amazing change stories and testimonials and case studies that are happening on the ground from clinical practice, brilliant, brilliant medical schools that have completely embedded nutrition and lifestyle medicine. So all future doctors will be trained. Imperial, absolutely on top. UCL, doing brilliantly. Barts, Bristol, Brighton and Sussex. Some of them even have dietitians as part of their medical school faculty that are solely in charge of putting more nutrition in the curriculum. So there is so much change. It's just, like I said, pockets of good practice, bottom up examples. It's very hard to actually take a huge NHS top down approach and say it changes on the way. But when you're in it, like I am, I'm seeing so many positive shifts. And I'm very hopeful. And we've got so many collaborating organizations. It's not just us that want this change. We've got NEDPRO. We've got loads of the Royal Colleges who, like RCGP, have lifestyle medicine leads embedded within them. So yeah, I'm actually very hopeful.
Can I ask you about the Eat Well guide? Because everyone I speak to about this seems to have a different strong reaction to it. Yeah. Ranging from the it's completely right to it's I've never seen anything so wrong. So for example, if someone doesn't know, it still recommends that about a third of daily intake comes from starchy sources, starchy carbohydrates, right? What's your take on this? Are we still giving out fundamentally sound nutritional information?
Yeah, I think it's a really complex question. I'm only going to give a brief answer because I'm not a nutrition expert. I'm a nutrition education systems expert, is what I like to say. So we've got registered nutritionists and dietitians on our team who have actually delivered webinars exactly on this issue. So taking some key principles from what I will say is that you have to ask yourself, is it culturally inclusive? So I'm a big fan of some dietitians in our network, Pooja Dear and Farika J, who have made a South Asian and Afro-Caribbean Eat Well guide. So it can actually be culturally inclusive when you're giving these suggestions, because what's the point in giving blanket nutrition suggestions to someone who doesn't know how to even use the ingredients that you're suggesting because it's not part of their culture? So that's the first kind of point I'd make. I'd also make the point about how can we do better without just kind of getting into an absolute spiral and maze of, well, if we suggest this, this might not be appropriate for this population. If we suggest this, it might not be appropriate for this population. I think it is unbelievably hard from a public health perspective to create nutrition guidelines as a bottom line. I think we know that some people will need to reduce their salt because they've got hypertension, but we know that other people need to have ample amounts of salt in their diet if they have any sort of other specific condition. And other examples of eating disorders and obesity, you can give complete different interventions, and one will impact the others. Look at calories on restaurant menus. That was to help the obesity population, and it completely was detrimental to the eating disorder population. So the Eat Well guide, my commentary is, it's very hard. I do feel for everyone who has had to put that together to make a public health nutrition guide, because we are all so different. We're all individuals. There is no one size fits all. So I find it very hard to even comment on it, because I would try and meet my patient where they're at when I'm suggesting dietary interventions based on their metabolic health, their mental health, their cultural background, what chronic conditions they may have, what medications they're taking, because you need to be mindful of that as well. So what's my commentary on it? Is it fit for purpose? Probably not. But at the same time, I'm highly in respect of the people that have created it, because I think it's an incredibly hard job. But we need to have a more personalized approach, and webinars and workshops to actually help people with those consultation skills of meeting patients where they're at and having personalized approaches for different chronic conditions and for different cultural backgrounds. And you can't expect one guide to be able to encompass that all. So, yeah, quite a politician-y answer, because I generally think it's a very hard job.
Speaking of politics, it's a joke that the easiest way to start a fight online is to talk about politics or nutrition. You mentioned influencers earlier, and in my world, obviously I'm surrounded by health and fitness influencers, and there are a lot of people giving nutrition advice who clearly don't have any knowledge or experience to do so. To me, it feels like it's an overwhelming problem because I'm so exposed to it, but I'm really interested in speaking to you from the medical professional side of things. Is this something that is on your radar a lot as a profession, that people are coming in saying, well, I've seen this online and someone online has told me to do it? Is that on your radar?
It is overwhelming. It's, for me, my biggest issue right now that I want to be part of solving. So absolutely resonate with what you've just said. Nutrition online misinformation is so rife and so harmful that I worry we're going to see a cascade of issues that come from it because of how accessible social media is. And at the end of the day, not everyone makes it into the healthcare professional sphere because of waiting lists, because of short consultation times in the NHS. And sometimes the information that's given, e.g. a leaflet for hypertension, e.g. Whatever the pamphlet they're given, isn't the type of information people want to consume in terms of modality. They'd rather go onto social media and access things in a more engaging way. So I think we have to improve and regulate health information on social media urgently. Like, I couldn't be more urgent about it. NutriTank are actually working on a research project that will be surveying this exact issue in different populations, whether it's healthcare professionals, personal trainers, and the public, about what the current situation actually is when it comes to online nutrition information and what the current essentially harmful consequences could be. So a lot of the focus groups that we've already held have already identified that dietitians and nutritionists are getting a lot of questions from patients, like saying, do I need to have a continuous glucose monitor? Do I need to go on a carnivore diet because certain influencers are talking about how beneficial just cutting out all fruits and vegetables are and going on a pro carnivore diet is. Do I need to go completely plant-based because all the vegan propaganda that we see on Netflix with these documentaries that are completely biased to one side are making me so scared that if I consume any animal products, I'm going to get this whole host of disease. There is a dietary wars at play right now. There are dietary religions, and there are very, very biased perspectives out there that do not allow the people, as I spoke about, Joe, to make an informed decision from the menu of what is on offer. And that is what I will always say to a patient. It is totally your choice whether you want to eat meat, whether you want to have legumes and grains, whether you want to have a low carb approach or not, depending on what your clinical need is. And I think if we don't allow people to make up their own minds by giving them all the information, then we are essentially doing a huge disservice, because that's biased health information. So we have put together a team, and we're writing a research paper about this at the moment. And we are also working with Royal Society of Medicine, and are hosting a, it's yet to be advertised, so you've heard it here first. We are hosting, I'm on their council, and so RSM are hosting an online nutrition misinformation conference called How to Sort the Weed from the Chaff on November the 18th, 2024, where we're having multiple panels and keynotes addressing how does misinformation and fake news spread. Because there was a Twitter X study done a few years ago that actually highlights that the algorithms favor fake news and more extreme piece of information. So it spreads faster than a researcher getting onto X or Twitter saying, in this paper, we found that for certain populations, this diet would be more appropriate. However, we aren't able to fully conclude that social media doesn't like nuance. So that good quality information doesn't spread. But what does spread is everyone needs to be on a carnivore diet, or everyone needs to eat what I eat in a day as a influencer, or everyone needs to buy my product that I'm selling because I've had results for me. That's what spreads and sells. So we'll be addressing that in a conference with some of the key experts, people from big tech, people from public health, people from academia, and media dietitians, media medics, and media nutritionists who are doing this very well, who will be able to actually leave the delegates from the conference with perhaps a toolkit of how you can spot misinformation online. Because for me, Joe, it's my biggest worry right now.
I spoke recently to Dr. Alan Flanagan, who's a nutritional researcher, who said the war on social media for nutrition, good nutrition advice, has been lost, right? You simply cannot, for every bad influencer you knock down, 10 more crop up in their place. And obviously they're offering attractive solutions, which people want to hear, which is all part of the problem. Would you agree with him that the war has been lost? His view is all we can really do is kind of create these islands out in the storm that hopefully enough people will be cast away onto and find the information they need. Are you more positive than that? Can this war be won, or is it a case of just trying to give people what little hope when they're ready for it?
Right. So obviously it comes down to what your echo chamber is and what you're consuming. So it can feel really, really disenchanting at times, because obviously what I consume, and I'm sure what Alan consumes, is very similar. And so it can feel like, oh gosh, we're really at a loss here. I carry hope, because I think you have to have a top down and bottom up approach. And the fact that YouTube have a whole new innovation now, run by Dr. Vishal Virani, an ex-NHS doctor who's the head of health at YouTube, a UK and Ireland. The fact that they now have an entire team dedicated to YouTube health and a new intervention called the Health Shelf on YouTube, where you have to apply and it is a bit of a process, but it essentially favours healthcare professionals' content on subjects, so that when the public goes on the search bar on YouTube to say, how do I prevent a stress fracture when running, whatever the question is, they will then kind of be signposted towards the Health Shelf, which has verified healthcare professionals creating the content rather than prioritizing the influencers, and it's on a specific shelf so you can go to it for all your different needs within health. So I think the fact that big tech in YouTube are really piloting this approach and they're getting involved, it fills me with a lot of hope, and I know the team well, because the impact they can have from that top-down approach is absolutely massive. And likewise, the WHO, the World Health Organization, now have a program called the FIDES program. FIDES is Latin for loyal or trustworthy, whatever, but It's a healthcare influencer program, which I'm on as well, which essentially was created during COVID to help reduce the spread of misinformation around health. And it's an application process, and they've brought on board lots of healthcare professional influencers globally to essentially be part of spreading good quality, credible health information in general. And so that essentially carries a lot of hope for me, because if huge global organizations, either in the tech or public health and policy space, are realizing this is an issue and are creating solutions, no matter how long they'll take to become mainstream, I'm filled with hope that we're not alone as individual healthcare professionals being worried about this situation. I just think there needs to be more education around how to actually spot who's good quality information, what's good quality information to consume and what's not. So like I mentioned before, the what I eat in a day videos with body checks and things like that, that's obviously someone who's trying to sell you how they look and say, well, this works for me, that works for you. People who promote a product for everyone without any nuance, because we know with the Eat Well Guide example, one product isn't going to help an entire population. It will help a certain segment of the population. Anyone who is essentially fear-mongering, demonizing foods or demonizing certain things and invoking fear, I think that is a huge red flag. Who are demonizing big, you know, food groups and people without credible qualifications, or pathologize normal bodily functions and make you worry. So I think there are a lot of tools we can teach people on how to spot this stuff. So I'm a bit hopeful, but it's very worrying, as Alan has pointed out.
You would think that it would be a significant enough red flag for simply having your top off or being in a crop top, right? But I guess that clearly isn't enough for most people. So the work must continue. Yeah. Finally, and much more generally, what's life like as a junior doctor? Because for most of us on the outside, all we really hear is what we're presented to on the mainstream media, be it newspapers or TV. Can you paint a picture of what it's like for people who just don't know, who haven't spoken to junior doctors?
$1 million question. So I've been a junior doctor for 3 years now. I did my foundation program, which is what you do straight after medical school, for 2 years. I finished that in August 23, and I have been on what is loosely called an F3 year. So I've actually been locuming this year and been focusing more on the media work that I do and the NutriTank work that I do and the mental health public speaking work that I do. And then I'm going into my psychiatry specialty training August 24 in a couple months to train as a psychiatrist. And for those that don't know, a junior doctor is someone who isn't a GP or isn't a consultant. So even when I'm in my final years of training as a psychiatrist, but I'm not quite a consultant, but I've done 14 years outside of medical school or whatever, or less than that, but I'm still considered a junior doctor. So it's quite a problematic term in terms of how it actually values the healthcare professional. But yeah, what's life like? Once I finished medical school, I did 2 years of the foundation program. Every 4 months, you rotate around to a different specialty. So you finish the 2 years with a well-rounded approach, and then you decide what specialty route you want to go down. And it's a very dynamic job. You're moving teams every 4 months. You'll get comfortable working in geriatrics. Then you'll move to general surgery. It's very stop-start, and there's not a lot of continuity with your teams and who you work with because you're rotating so much. But it is really exciting. I do love being a junior doctor. But of course, for me, the biggest issue I find is how valued are we? And one piece of the puzzle of that is the junior doctor strikes and pay. And that's been in the news massively. But I think it's a much wider conversation around how well are junior doctors and healthcare professionals in general valued when you're on night shifts or weekend shifts and there isn't food, nutritious food for you to consume and have food that's productive for your brain health to then be able to continue with the stamina that you need to help patients throughout the day. There aren't good sleeping facilities. There isn't free parking a lot of the time. You have to pay for your parking. So how well do we value the junior doctor that is minimally paid, is in a situation where they are saving lives, essentially life or death situations, and the food that is on offer is expensive and it's not nutritious and all the other facilities and amenities that one would expect in a healthy workplace aren't really present for the junior doctor and other healthcare staff. So what's life like? It's complicated. I love it. I'm very dedicated to the NHS. I'm very excited to start my psychiatry career. But I think the way that junior doctors and other healthcare staff are valued is very problematic. There is just not enough supporting their well-being in the workplace by any stretch.
What's your advice for somebody considering a career in medicine? I mean, would if you could go back and do things differently, would you still do it? Or how would you... dissuade somebody from following in your footsteps?
Yeah, it's definitely tricky. I'm very passionate about healthcare. There's nothing else I would really do in terms of whatever that looks like, whether it's me not being full-time clinical and doing media advocacy work around healthcare. Regardless, I'm really passionate about it. And I think I wouldn't do anything differently from what I've done so far because I've been very lucky due to my own hard work that I've created a portfolio career for myself whereby I can wear lots of different hats and have fingers in different pies and not necessarily need to be full-time in the NHS because I do public health advocacy work and all of that, and that's what kind of fills my cup, and variety for me is what kind of keeps my well-being at bay. So I would kind of say to someone considering a career in medicine, I would say make sure it's not your whole life is what I would say. If you're passionate about it, I would say follow it. Being a doctor is one of the most privileging things ever, to be able to help someone at their most vulnerable, and the ripple effect you can have on their relatives, their family, their community, if you can help them restore their health. But make sure you do not pin your identity on it, and make sure that you have more outlets in your life beyond clinical medicine, because I think that's how you burn out and that's how you can become disillusioned and disenchanted. So I think retaining hobbies and other professional interests are hugely important, and making sure that you really, really want it, because it's a complete and utter vocation and lifestyle choice for sure.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.